CJSF.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. We strive to provide perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media. If you'd like to know more about us, check out our website at cjsf.ca.
How often have major media outlets questioned Secretary of State Antony Blinken or President Biden and said, how would you feel if your son or daughter was blown up courtesy of U.S. taxpayers? Why don't you insist that Israel stop bombing or all of the weapons will be cut off? These are basic, logical questions, but when they are avoided, then we're getting this sort of parody of journalism, which is more stenography than anything else.
That's Norman Solomon, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Norman Solomon on war and the media. In times of war, the corporate media play a salient role in shaping public opinion. There are worthy and unworthy victims. They neatly divide certain categories. Muslims, Arabs, and Iranians generally fall into that latter category, whereas Washington and its allies are worthy victims who deserve our support and empathy. The current phase of the Gaza war did not begin on October 7th, as the media repeat ad nauseum. But to dig into the underlying causes and provide context and history rarely occurs because it would undermine the dominant propaganda. Thus, the Nora O'Donnells, Wolf Blitzers, Lester Holtz, and other corporate news anchors don't question the embedded assumptions and simply mimic, with few exceptions, the dominant official line. Our guest today is Norman Solomon. He's a political commentator and media critic. He's the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and co-founder of RootsAction.org, an online activist group. He's the author of many books. His latest is War Made Invisible. I talked with him on October 11th. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, you wrote War Made Invisible before the Israeli attack on Gaza in response to the events of October 7th. And then you've crucially have added an afterword. Talk about the ingredients of that and how things have evolved.
I thought a lot when I was working on the afterword about the Gaza war. I tried to grasp how the events after October 7th, 2023, have related to the basic themes of the initial book. After all, the title War Made Invisible might at first, you know, seem counterintuitive because the Gaza war got tremendous and has gotten to some degree still a significant amount of U.S. media coverage. But it became really clear that the quantity of coverage didn't mean that the war itself has been visible. After all, the realities of war are death, maiming, terror, and very little of that has come through the news media coverage of the Gaza war, I think for two basic reasons. One is the inherent limitations of journalism to convey what it's really like to have missiles and bombs coming at you and the carnage and the death and the suffering, the loss, the mourning, the grief. Very difficult for TV, radio, newspapers, scrolling on a screen to convey to us what that's like, you know, to be in a war zone. But the invisibility has really been compounded by the tremendous media bias that we've gotten from mainstream U.S. media outlets. It doesn't mean that occasionally there aren't breakthrough stories that will shatter the invisible shield that separates us from the realities of war. But the essence of propaganda is repetition. The code words, the catchphrases, the frame of reference, and the silences. So the invisibility of what has been going on now into its second year in Gaza, I think, has been a huge factor in insulating and numbing people in the United States from what is being done, really, if not explicitly in our names, certainly with our tax dollars and with U.S. government support. And then there's the subtitle of the book, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. And at first glance, the U.S. military machine is not directly involved with what's been going on in Gaza. But if you go under the surface, really, the Pentagon and the Israeli military are pretty much joined at the hip. There are occasional disagreements, sometimes even at top level, U.S. president, Israeli prime minister. But underneath that is a tremendous synergy, ways in which really the Israeli military is functionally an adjunct to the U.S. war machine. And so that is also very much hidden from the U.S. public. The bombs and missiles that have been falling and continue to fall in Gaza and now also more recently in Lebanon, they are directly, in most cases, coming from the United States.
You write in the afterword that the extreme decimation in Gaza was foreshadowed from the outset. Explain what you mean.
Within the hours after October 7th, as the reporting came in, top Israeli officials said that we're going to shut down Gaza. No food, no medicine, nothing is going to get in. This was a magnification, a great acceleration of policy that has been in place for decades, where Israel has restricted what can go in, what can come out of Gaza, what's been called the largest open-air prison in the world. Some people say, well, not a great analogy since the people inside the open-air prison have done nothing really wrong. The vast majority of them simply civilians. In any case, in this instance, the gauntlet that was thrown down by Israeli leaders within hours of the news about the crimes of October 7th really did foreshadow what was coming up, because it was basically a declaration of war, primarily on the civilians. After all, the UN has documented that the deaths in Gaza because of the ongoing Israeli assault are overwhelmingly children and women. And it was an attitude from the Israeli government proclaimed that we simply will not have any compunction about decimating Gaza. And in fact, that's what has happened. The documentation is pretty clear now that certainly in this century, the speed and rate of slaughter of children and women in Gaza is unprecedented.
I don't like to use the term defense minister, but I guess I have to. The Israeli war minister, Yoav Gallant, said, "We are fighting human animals and we are acting accordingly." This is very interesting terminology. I mean, you might know that I have a background in, I'm Armenian and my family went through a genocide. And one of the key components of that Turkish genocide in 1915 was the dehumanization and the demonization of the Armenians. And they were called, all kinds of names, talked about in disparaging terms as animals, disease-ridden, etc. And it seems to be part and parcel of what happened. And again, the Germans did it during the Holocaust vis-a-vis Jews, Gypsies, communists, socialists, demonization and dehumanization, core ingredients of genocide.
David, as you made that, I think, very profound point about the objectification of people in order to rationalize genocide, I was thinking of a quote that actually begins War Made Invisible from Aldous Huxley, which he uttered and in an awful way foreshadowed what was to come in the following few years, Huxley said, the propagandist's purpose is to make one set of people forget that certain other sets of people are human. And once that bridge is crossed, then all kinds of atrocities are possible. The very conceit that news media are conveying to us what war is really all about is part of the numbing process. Because if we really believe that we understand what is going on, for instance, in Gaza, because we watch TV, listen to National Public Radio, whatever, through the mainstream media, then we're subjecting ourselves to a delusion that further insulates us from what war really is. And that makes supporting or at least accepting the war more possible.
You're right in the afterword, something about happened earlier this year. I'm quoting now. The United States cast the only vote in the UN Security Council against the resolution for a ceasefire in Gaza, the third time that the U.S. voted to block such a resolution. It was, you continue, yet another move to serve as the main enabler for Israel's mass murder of Palestinian people. The cruelty and magnitude of the slaughter were abhorrent to anyone not somehow numb to the human agony. Such numbing has been widespread in the United States. Some factors, you write, include ethnocentric, racial, and religious biases against Arabs and Muslims. Talk about that a little bit.
The images come from Hollywood, from the language of mainstream pundits, from the imagery of news media, and also what's left out, the silences, the omissions, the lack of conveying the humanity of people, because at the one level, they simply are different than us, but more than that, they've been vilified through stereotypes and so forth. I have to say, when you look at the brilliant work of Edward Said over a period of many decades, how did people in the United States learn of what he had to say? Well, to a significant degree, it was if they listened to alternative radio. I mean, this is a radio program that has been able, willing to convey the voices of Edward Said, of Noam Chomsky, of others who, going back several decades, were willing to articulate on their basis of their scholarship and their humanity, how these stereotypes and cliches and really vicious characterizations of Arab Muslim people are completely absurd if they're measured up against our common humanity. And I think that today, especially younger people, are shedding that kind of delusionary separation between different people on the planet based on their usual ethnocentric divisions that are exploited, created, magnified by the news media and politics of the country. And it's very discouraging to me, but I think we do need to name it, that although younger people in this country have often, because of their access to other forms of communication about Gaza events through social media and online and so forth, have gotten increasingly wise to the cruelty and really the human disconnection that has dominated mass media and politics, when you go into the mass media and politics of the country, there has been only a very slow improvement in this status quo baseline that has really enabled Israel to continue to inflict ethnic cleansing on Palestinian people, now overt mass murder in Gaza, and by most definitions, genocide.
You write about, I'm quoting, the brawny arms of the Israel lobby. Talk about that. We hear the acronym APEC quite a bit, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the major U.S.-based pro-Israel lobby, which spent millions of dollars to defeat Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman. They were both running for the House of Representatives, seeking re-election. and they were defeated with millions of dollars from AIPAC to ensure that defeat.
AIPAC is really playing now in a huge way in the electoral arena. They didn't used to do it so overtly. And as you mentioned, both Jamal Bowman in Bronx and Westchester in New York, and then Cori Bush in St. Louis were defeated not by grassroots opposition in their districts, but by these huge quantities, many, many millions of dollars of advertising and attacks. I think parallel to those kind of electoral efforts are the 24/7, 365 efforts by outlets like ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which I think with Truth in Packaging should be called the Defamation League Against Palestinians, because that's what has been one of the main missions of ADL for a very long time. And it has cranked up since last spring. So many campuses went into upheaval in opposition to the continued U.S. government support for genocide against Palestinian people in Gaza, and demanding that their colleges sever any support or financial investments that are helping Israel to continue with its policies. And ADL and Aligned Forces really just went into overdrive, smearing the protesters as anti-Semitic, which, of course, is ironic given that so many leaders of those protests were Jewish themselves, as I happen to be. And so this is an effort to ratchet up the scam that has had tremendous propaganda impact in this country and has increased in terms of its intensity since October 7th, 2023, where the Israeli government perpetrating these ongoing crimes of occupation, of ethnic cleansing, now of really genocide in Gaza, that government wraps itself in Judaism. And then criticism of the actions of that government are then labeled and denounced as anti-Semitic. And I think it's notable that although there has been some pushback increasing from the grassroots and even in U.S. mass media on that technique, it still is dominant. It still is reflexive, and it has enormous salience, or at least impact, coming from mass media.
As you alluded to, among critics of Israel and U.S. Mideast policy are many Jews. You are Jewish, as are Amy Goodman, Noam Chomsky, Jeff Cohen, Naomi Klein, Medea Benjamin, Norman Finkelstein, and many others. The Jewish voice for peace on and off campus has been very prominent in protests and demonstrations. But that establishment-oriented organizations of American Jews have a much louder presence and influence. How to counteract that louder presence and influence?
Really, we have, I think, the necessity, certainly the opportunity, to say that we need a single standard of human rights, that it's a basic question of human equality, and that we can't, we certainly shouldn't, pick and choose and say, oh, now we have this precept of what human rights are and should be, and then we just cast it aside. We don't accept the Orwellian notion, the doublethink, that says that you take an idea and you take it off the shelf and utilize it only when it's convenient, and then you put it back on the shelf when it becomes inconvenient. The fact is that Israel has been and is more than ever an apartheid state. And there was a huge transformation in U.S. society during the last several decades where acceptance of apartheid South Africa, largely because of protests and upheaval on college campuses and elsewhere in the 1980s, support for apartheid South Africa became unacceptable. And gradually, U.S. policy shifted out of necessity because the facts on the ground, so to speak, became such that apartheid in South Africa became untenable. Reality is that Israel as an apartheid state gets away with it because in U.S. media and politics, overwhelmingly, it's not acknowledged to be an apartheid state. And yet the Israeli human rights group, B'Tselem, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, they all have come out with unequivocal reports that Israel is an apartheid state.
You write, melding Israel with Judaism is a core distortion that enables defenders of Israeli actions to cry anti-Semitism. Explain.
It's really been, I think, in a macabre way, a brilliant strategy that has been in effect for so many decades, and especially after the foundation of Israel, Zionism became, sometimes reluctantly by mainstream Jewish organizations in the U.S., seen to be necessary. There was substantial Jewish, organized and unorganized Jewish opposition to Zionism, to the idea that Israel is necessary to have a quote-unquote Jewish state. But once it became a fait accompli, and then especially after the 1967 war, more and more the organized Jewish organizations with power in the U.S. basically became an adjunct to the Israeli propaganda machine. Recently, when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came to the United States and met with Jewish organizations, their leaderships, the head of the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, assured Netanyahu that ADL was committed to working very, very closely with the Israeli government to get its message out. And the message in all sorts of permutations is that Israel is the Jewish faith, and that if you are going to raise questions about Israel's behavior, its public policy, its military actions, that you somehow are falling into a trap of anti-Semitism. I write in the book about the cover story that Time magazine wrote just a few months after the Israeli assault began in Gaza, and it had a Jewish star filling the front cover. And keep in mind, this is the largest news weekly circulation in the United States. And the headline in the middle of the Jewish star was "The New Anti-Semitism." And this is, among other things, an assault on groups, including Jewish Voice for Peace and If Not Now, led by Jews, saying that essentially criticism of Israel is an assault on Judaism itself. And so it gets, I want to say weird, but it's actually, from a propaganda standpoint, very logical, because it's worked in the past. It's seen as a winning combination of various messages sort of braided together. And so the net effect, for instance, with this huge cover story in Time magazine, was to tell the readers that because of the Holocaust, Jews running the Israeli government and Israel itself should get a pass, get out of jail card, so to speak. Whereas if you had the single standard of human rights and you apply it to Israel, then you would have to condemn the apartheid system. You'd need to condemn ethnic cleansing.
You know, there are some really good independent sources of information. I'm thinking right now of The Intercept, which somehow got its hands on an internal memo circulating at the New York Times, where journalists were to avoid using the terms, I'm quoting here, genocide, ethnic cleansing, refugee camps, occupied territory, and even further discouraging referring to Palestine as Palestine whatsoever. In addition, the memo claims that words like slaughter, massacre, and carnage are too emotional to describe Israel's bombardment of Gaza. What do you think of all of that?
That's really illuminating. And here's a very poignant fact in that context. When The Intercept news site did a rigorous study of the first 6 weeks of the Gaza war and looked at the content of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, they found that the word slaughter was used to describe what Hamas had done to Israelis, it was used 60 different times. And that same word, slaughter, was used only once in describing what Israel had done to Palestinian people. And then you go to the word massacre. In that six-week period, those three media outlets used the word massacre 125 times to describe what Hamas had done to Israelis, and used the word massacre a grand total of two times to describe what Israel was doing and had been doing to people in Gaza. And that even understates the disparity of regard for the humanity of Israelis versus Palestinians, because by that point, in the first 6 weeks, many more Palestinians had been killed than those had been killed, than Israelis had been killed by people in Hamas. So I think this is, if you will, a numerical quantification of the regard that these leading, very influential U.S. media outlets have for the humanity of Israelis compared to Palestinians. We really have a numerical, not only anecdotal, but empirical way to measure the inhumanity of our own major media outlets. And there is this sort of circular relationship between people in the White House and on Capitol Hill on the one hand, and media on the other, because the mainline media and the top politicians are walking, if not in lockstep, then in very close proximity. They take nods from each other. They are acutely aware of what is defined as the reasonable bounds of discussion. We have the disparity here that is so extreme that it amounts to the dehumanization of certain people. I describe it as two levels of grief, where conveyed overtly and more subtly, the suffering, the mourning, the sense of loss, the humanity of some people is conveyed very viscerally, very emotionally and empathetically for certain people, Americans, countries where designated allies of the United States are in charge. And then there's the flip side, the dehumanization. One contrast that I think in contemporary times is really simultaneous, and that is the U.S. media coverage of the suffering in Ukraine as a result of the really illegal and immoral Russian invasion and war on Ukraine. And there's been a tremendous quantity of human interest stories, of empathy, of outrage in terms of U.S. media coverage of what has been going on, the bombing of hospitals, the targeting of civilian infrastructure, the deaths and suffering in Ukraine. And when you contrast it to the equivocal kind of coverage that has been only occasional in terms of actually conveying the individual, the personal lives of people in Palestine, it's quite striking. Even then, when you look at, and there have been some good stories, some empathetic stories about individuals, families in Palestine, it is what Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky have described as victims without victimizers. So the indirection is what's conveyed in terms of Israeli culpability. Yes, Israel clearly drops the bombs. U.S. media coverage is sometimes critical of them doing it. But the benefit of the doubt is often given, routinely given, that, well, it's not that they're intentionally killing the Palestinian civilians, but they're being really careless. They're engaged in disregard and being sloppy about it, not really taking the kind of care that they should. And even less culpability is ascribed to Washington. And it's rarely talked about in U.S. media that this slaughter going on in Gaza would be really impossible without the U.S. arms shipments and the pipeline that continues. And I've thought a lot about the continuity of propaganda assumptions, which are often the most pernicious. And I could mention just a few really quickly, where the pattern set after 9/11 with the so-called war on terror have really been very entrenched in terms of U.S. media and politics with